last. It had gone a little soft, but the flesh was still tart and juicy. He was down to the core when he heard the sounds. Horses. And from the north. Quickly, John leapt up and strode to his mare. Could he outrun them? No, they were too close. They'd hear him for a certainty. And if they were from Castle Black... He led the mare off the road behind a thick stand of grey-green sentinels. "Quiet now," he said in a hushed voice, crouching down to peer through the branches. If the guards were kind, the riders would pass by. Likely as not, they were only small folk from Molestown, farmers on their way to the fields, although what they were doing out in the middle of the night... He listened to the sound of hooves growing steadily louder as they trotted briskly down the King's Road. From the sound, there were five or six of them, at the least. Their voices drifted through the trees.
"Certainly came this way?" "We can't be certain. He could have ridden east, for all you know, or left the road to cut through the woods. That's what I'd do.
In the dark, stupid. If you didn't fall off your horse and break your neck, you'd get lost and wind up back at the wall when the sun came up."
"I would not," Gren sounded peeved. "I'd just ride south. You can tell south by the stars."
"What if the sky was cloudy?" Pip asked.
"Well, then I wouldn't go."
Another voice broke in.
"You know where I'd be, if it was me? I'd be in Molestown, digging for buried treasure."
Toad's shrill laughter boomed through the trees. John's mare snorted.
"Keep quiet, all of you,"
Alder said.
"I thought I heard something."
"Where?
I didn't hear anything."
The horses stopped.
"You can't hear yourself far."
"I can too," Gren insisted. "Quiet."
They all fell silent, listening. John found himself holding his breath.
Sam, he thought.
He hadn't gone to the old bear, but he hadn't gone to bed either. He'd woken the other boys.
Damn them all.
Come dawn, if they were not in their beds, they'd be named deserters too. What did they think they were doing? The hushed silence seemed to stretch on and on. From where John crouched, he could see the legs of their horses through the branches. Finally, Pip spoke up.
"What did you hear?"
"I don't know," Alder admitted. "A sound, I thought. It might have been a horse, but..."
"There's nothing here."
Out of the corner of his eye, John glimpsed a pale shape moving through the trees. Leaves rustled, and ghosts came bounding out of the shadows, so suddenly that John's mare started and gave a whinny.
"There!"
Alder shouted.
"I heard it too."
"Traitor,"
John told the direwolf as he swung up into the saddle. He turned the mare's head to slide off through the trees, but they were on him before he had gone 10 feet.
"John!"
Pip shouted after him.
"Pull up," Gren said. "You can't outrun us all."
John wheeled around to face them, drawing his sword.
"Get back. I don't wish to hurt you, but I will if I have to."
"One against seven,"
Alder gave the signal. The boys spread out, surrounding him.
"What do you want with me?" John demanded. "We want to take you back where you belong," Pip said. "I belong with my brother." "Where are your brothers now?" Gren said. "They'll cut off your head if they catch you, you know," Tud put in with a nervous laugh.
"This is so stupid, it's like something the Oryx would do."
"I would not," Gren said. "I'm no oathbreaker. I said the words and I meant them."
"So did I," John told them. "Don't you understand? They murdered my father. It's war. My brother Rob is fighting in the Riverlands."
"We know," Pip said solemnly. "Sam told us everything."
"We're sorry about your father," Gren said. "But it doesn't matter. Once you say the words, you can't leave, no matter what."
"I have to," John said fervently. "You said the words," Pip reminded him. "Now my watch begins." "You said it. It shall not end until my death." "I shall live and die at my post," Gren said, nodding.
"You don't have to tell me the words. I know them as well as you do."
He was angry now. Why couldn't they let him go in peace? They were only making it harder.
"I am the sword in the darkness,"
Alder intoned.
"The watcher on the walls," piped Toad.
John cursed them all to their faces. They took no notice. Pip spurred his horse closer, reciting, "I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men." "Stay back," John warned him, brandishing his sword. I mean it, Pip." They weren't even wearing armour. He could cut them to pieces if he had to. Mathar had circled behind him. He joined the chorus.
"I pledge my life and honour to the night's watch."
John kicked his mare, spinning her in a circle. The boys were all around him now, closing from every side.
"For this night," Halder trotted in from the left. "And all the nights to come."
"Finish, Pip." He reached over for John's reins.
"So air your choices. Kill me, or come back with me."
John lifted his sword and lowered it helpless.
"Damn you," he said. "Damn you all. Do we have to bind your hands, or will you give us your word you will ride back peaceful?" asked Halder.
"I won't run, if that's what you mean." Ghost moved out from under the trees, and John glared at him. "Small help you were," he said. The deep red eyes looked at him knowingly.
"We'd best hurry," Pip said. "If we're not back before first light, the old bear will have all our heads."
On the ride back, John Snow remembered little. It seemed shorter than the journey south, perhaps because his mind was elsewhere. Pip set the pace, galloping, walking, trotting, and then breaking into another gallop. Mole's Town came and went, the red lantern over the brothel long extinguished. They made good time. Dawn was still an hour off when John glimpsed the towers of Castle Black ahead of them, dark against the pale immensity of the wall. It did not seem like home this time. They could take him back, John told himself, but they could not make him stay. The war would not end on the morrow or the day after, and his friends could not watch him day and night. He would bide his time, make them think he was content to remain here. And then, when they had grown lax, he would be off again. Next time, he would avoid the King's Road. He could follow the wall east, perhaps all the way to the sea. A longer route, but a safer one. Or even west, to the mountains, and then south over the high passes. That was the wildling's way, hard and perilous, but at least no one would follow him. He wouldn't stray within 100 leagues of Winterfell or the King's Road. Samuel Tarly awaited them in the old stables, slumped on the ground against a bale of hay, too anxious to sleep. He rose and brushed himself off.
I'm glad they found you, John.
I'm not, John said, dismounting. Pip hopped off his horse and looked at the lightning sky with disgust.
Give us a hand bedding down the horses, Sam, the small boy said. We have a long day before us, and no sleep to face it on, thanks to Lord Snow.
When day broke, John walked to the kitchens, as he did every dawn. Three-finger Hub said nothing as he gave him the old bear's breakfast. Today it was 3 brown eggs boiled hard, with fried bread and ham steak, and a bowl of wrinkled plums. John carried the food back to the King's Tower. He found Mormont at the window seat, writing. His raven was walking back and forth across his shoulders, muttering,
"Corn! Corn! Corn!"
The bird shrieked when John entered.
"Put the food on the table," the old bear said, glancing up. "I'll have some beer."
John opened a shuttered window, took the flagon of beer off the outside ledge, and filled a horn. Hob had given him a lemon, still cold from the wall. John crushed it in his fist. The juice trickled through his fingers. Mormont drank lemon in his beer every day and claimed that was why he still had his own teeth.
"Doubtless you loved your father," Mormont said, when John brought him his horn. "The things we love destroy us every time, lad. Remember when I told you that?"
"I remember," John said sullenly. He did not care to talk of his father's death, not even to Mormont.
"See that you never forget it. The hard truths are the ones to hold tight. Fetch me my plate.
Ugh, is it ham again? So be it. You look weary. Was your moonlight ride so tiring?
John's throat was dry. You know.
No.
The raven echoed from Mormont's shoulder.
No.
The old bear snorted.
Do you think they chose me Lord Commander of the Night's Watch because I'm dumb as a stump, Snow? Aemon told me you'd go. I told him you'd be back. I know my men, and my boys, too. Honor set you on the King's Road, and honor brought you back.
My friends brought me back, John said.
Did I say it was your honor?
Mormont inspected his plate. They killed my father. Did you expect me to do nothing?
If truth be told, we expected you to do just as you did.
Mormont tried a plum, spit out the pit.
I ordered a watch kept over you. You were seen leaving. If your brothers had not fetched you back, you would have been taken along the way, and not by friends. Unless you have a horse with wings, like a raven. Do you?
No. John felt like a fool.
Pity. We could use a horse like that.
John stood tall. He told himself that he would die well. That much he could do at the least. I know the penalty for desertion, my lord. I'm not afraid to die.
Die!
The raven cried.
Nor live, I hope, Mormont said, cutting his ham with a dagger and feeding a bite to the bird. You have not deserted, yet. Here you stand. If we beheaded every boy who rode to Molestown in the night, only ghosts would guard the wall. Yet maybe you mean to flee again on the morrow, or a fortnight from now. Is that it? Is that your hope, boy?
John kept silent.
I thought so.
Mormont peeled the shell off a boiled egg.
Your father is dead, lad. Do you think you can bring him back?
No, he answered, sullen.
Good, Mormont said. We've seen the dead come back, you and me. It's not something I care to see again.
He ate the egg in two bites and flicked a bit of shell out from between his teeth.
Your brother is in the field with all the powers of the North behind him. Any one of his lord's bannermen commands more swords than you'll find in all the Night's Watch. Now why do you imagine they need your help, Are you such a mighty warrior? Or do you carry a grumpkin in your pocket to magic up your sword?
John had no answer for him. The raven was pecking at an egg, breaking the shell. Pushing his beak back through the hole, he pulled out morsels of white and yolk. The old bear sighed.
You are not the only one touched by this war. Like as not, my sister is marching in your brother's host, her and those daughters of hers, dressed in men's mail. Mage is a hoary old snark, stubborn, short-tempered and willful. Truth be told, I can hardly stand to be around the wretched woman. But that does not mean my love for her is any less than the love you bear your half-sisters.
Frowning, Mormont took his last egg and squeezed it in his fist until the shell crunched.
Or perhaps it does. Be that as it may, I still grieve if she was slain. Yet you don't see me running off. I said the words, just as you did. My place is here. Where is yours, boy?
I have no place, John wanted to say. I'm a bastard. I have no rights, no name, no mother. And now not even a father. The words would not come. I don't know.
I do, said Lord Commander Mormont. The cold winds are rising, Snow. Beyond the wall, the shadows lengthen. Cutter Pike writes of vast herds of elk streaming south and east toward the sea, and mammoths as well. He says one of his men discovered huge, misshapen footprints not 3 leagues from East Watch. Rangers in the Shadow Tower have found whole villages abandoned. And at night, Sir Denis says, they see fires in the mountains, huge blazes that burn from dusk to dawn. Corin Halfhand took a captive in the depths of the gorge, and the man swears that Mance Rayder is massing all his people in some new secret stronghold is found. To what end, the gods only know. Do you think your Uncle Benjen was the only ranger we've lost this past year?
Benjen!
The raven squawked, bobbing his head, bits of egg dribbling from his beak.
Benjen! Benjen!
No, John said. There had been others. Too many.
Do you think your brother's war is more important than ours?
The old man barked. John chewed his lip. The raven flapped its wings at him.
War! 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 War!
It sang.
It's not, Mormont told him. God save us, boy. You're not blind, and you're not stupid. When dead men come hunting in the night, do you think it matters who sits the Iron Throne?
No. John had not thought of it that way.
Your Lord Father sent you to us, John. Why? Who can say? Why? Why? Why?
The raven called.
All I know is that the blood of the first men flows in the veins of the Starks. The first men built the wall, and it said they remember things otherwise forgotten. And that beast of yours, he led us to the Whites, warned you of the dead man on the steps. Sir Jeremy would doubtless call that happenstance. Yet Sir Jeremy is dead, and I'm not.
Lord Mormont stabbed a chunk of ham with the point of his dagger.
I think you were meant to be here, and I want you and that wolf of yours with us when we go beyond the wall.
His words sent a chill of excitement down John's back. Beyond the wall?
You heard me. I mean to find Ben Stark, alive or dead.
He chewed and swallowed.
I will not sit here, meekly, and wait for the snows and the ice winds. We must know what is happening. This time, the Night's Watch will ride in force against the King beyond the wall, the others, or anything else that may be out there. I mean to command them myself.
He pointed his dagger at John's chest.
By custom, the Lord Commander Stuart is his squire as well. But I do not care to wake every morning wondering if you'd run off again. So I will have an answer from you, John Snow, and I will have it now. Are you a brother of the Night's Watch, or only a bastard boy who wants to play at war?
John Snow straightened himself and took a long, deep breath.
Forgive me, Father, Rob, Arya, Bran. Forgive me. I cannot help you. He has the truth of it. This is my place.
I am yours, my lord. Your man. I swear it. I will not run again. The old bear snorted.
Good. Now, go put on your sword.
The Queen's Hand. The Dornish prince was 3 days dying. He took his last shuddering breath in the bleak black dawn, as cold rain hissed from a dark sky to turn the brick streets of the old city into rivers. The rain had drowned the worst of the fires, but wisps of smoke still rose from the smouldering ruin that had been the Pyramid of Hazgar and the great black pyramid of Yerizan, where Rhaegal had made his lair, hulked in the gloom like a fat woman bedecked with glowing orange jewels.
"Perhaps the gods are not deaf after all," Sir Barristan Selmy reflected as he watched those distant embers. "If not for the rain, the fires might have consumed all of Meereen by now." He saw no sign of dragons, but he had not expected to. The dragons did not like the rain. A thin red slash marked the eastern horizon, where the sun might soon appear. It reminded Selmy of the first blood welling from a wound. Often, even with a deep cut, the blood came before the pain. He stood beside the parapets of the highest step of the Great Pyramid, searching the sky as he did every morning, knowing that the dawn must come, and hoping that his queen would come with it. "She will not have abandoned us. She would never leave her people," he was telling himself, when he heard the prince's death rattle coming from the queen's apartments. Sir Barristan went inside. Rainwater ran down the back of his white cloak, and his boots left wet tracks on the floors and carpets. At his command, Quentin Martell had been laid out in the queen's own bed. He had been a knight, and a prince of dawn besides. It seemed only kind to let him die in the bed he had crossed half a world to reach. The bedding was ruined. Sheets, covers, pillows, mattress, all reeked of blood and smoke. But Sir Barristan thought Daenerys would forgive him. Missandei sat at the bedside. She had been with the prince night and day, tending to such needs as he could express, giving him water and milk of the puppy when he was strong enough to drink, listening to the few tortured words he gasped out from time to time, reading to him when he fell quiet, sleeping in her chair beside him. Sir Barristan had asked some of the queen's cupbearers to help, but the sight of the burned man was too much for even the boldest of them, and the Blue Graces had never come, though he'd sent for them four times. Perhaps the last of them had been carried off by the pale mare by now. The tiny Nathi scribe looked up at his approach.
"Honoured sir, the prince is beyond pain now. His Dornish guards have taken him home. See, he smiles."
"How can you tell? He has no lips. It would have been kinder if the dragons had devoured him. That at least would have been quick. This
fire is a hideous way to die. Small wonder half the hells are made of flame. Cover him."
Missandei pulled the coverlet over the prince's face.
"What will be done with him, sir? He is so very far from home. I'll see that he is returned to dawn." "But how? As ashes?"
"That would require more fire, and Sir Barristan could not stomach that. We'll need to strip the flesh from his bones, beetles, not boiling." The Silent Sisters would have seen to it at home, but this was Slaver's Bay. The nearest Silent Sister was 10,000 leagues away. "You should go sleep now, child, in your own bed."
"If this one may be so bold, sir, you should do the same. You do not sleep the whole night through."
"Not for many years, child. Not since the Trident." Grand Maester Pycelle had once told him that old men do not need as much sleep as the young. But it was more than that. He had reached that age when he was loath to close his eyes, for fear that he might never open them again. Other men might wish to die in bed asleep, but that was no death for a knight of the King's Guard.
"The nights are too long," he told Missandei, "and there is much and more to do always, here as in the Seven Kingdoms. But you have done enough for now, child. Go and rest. And if the guards are good, you will not dream of dragons."
After the girl was gone, the old knight peeled back the coverlet for one last look at Quentin Martell's face, or what remained of it. So much of the prince's flesh had sloughed away that he could see the skull beneath. His eyes were pools of pus.
He should have stayed in dawn. He should have stayed a frog. Not all men are meant to dance with dragons.
As he covered the boy once more, he found himself wondering whether there would be anyone to cover his queen, or whether her own corpse would lie unmourned amongst the tall grasses of the Dothraki Sea, staring blindly at the sky until her flesh fell from her bones.
"No," he said aloud, "Daenerys is not dead. She was riding that dragon. I saw it with mine own two eyes."
He had said the same 100 times before, but every day that passed made it harder to believe. Her hair was afire. I saw that too. She was burning. And if I did not see her fall, hundreds swear they did.
Day had crept upon the city. Though the rain still fell, a vague light suffused the eastern sky. And with the sun arrived the shave-pate. Skarhaz was clad in his familiar garb of pleated black skirt, greaves, and muscled breastplate. The brazen mask beneath his arm was new, a wolf's head with lolling tongue.
"So," he said, by way of greeting, "the fool is dead, is he?"
"Prince Quentin died just before first light." Selmy was not surprised that Skarhaz knew. Word travelled quickly within the pyramid. "Is the council assembled?"
"They await the hand's pleasure below."
"I am no hand," a part of him wanted to cry out. "I am only a simple knight, the queen's protector. I never wanted this." But with the queen gone and the king in chains, someone had to rule, and Sir Barristan did not trust the shave-pate. "Has there been any word from the Green Grace?"
"She has not yet returned to the city."
Skarhaz had opposed sending the priestess, nor had Galaza Galare herself embraced the task. She would go, she allowed, for the sake of peace, but Hisdar Zoloric was better suited to treat with the wise masters. But Sir Barristan did not yield easily, and finally the Green Grace had bowed her head and sworn to do her best. "How stands the city?" Selmy asked the shave-pate now.
"All the gates are closed and barred, as you commanded. We are hunting down any sellswords or yunkai left inside the city, and expelling or arresting those we catch. Most seem to have gone to ground inside the pyramids, beyond a doubt. The unsolid man the walls and towers, ready for any assault. There are 200 highborn gathered in the square, standing in the rain in their tokars and howling for audience. They want Hisdar free, and me dead. And they want you to slay these dragons. Someone told them knights were good at that. Men are still pulling corpses from the pyramid of Haskar. The great masters of Yerizan and Ules have abandoned their own pyramids to the dragons."
Sir Barristan had known all that. "And the butcher's tally?" he asked, dreading the answer.
29.
29! That was far worse than he could ever have imagined. The Sons of the Harpy had resumed their shadow war 2 days ago. 3 murders the first night, 9 the second. But to go from 9 to 29 in a single night?
"The count will pass 30 before midday." "Why do you look so grey, old man? What did you expect? The Harpy wants Hisdar free, so he sent his sons back into the streets with knives in hand. The dead are all freemen and shave-pates, as before. One was mine, a brazen beast. The sign of the Harpy was left beside the bodies, chalked on the pavement or scratched into a wall. There were messages as well. 'Dragons must die,' they wrote, 'and Hargaz the hero.' 'Death to Daenerys' was seen as well before the rain washed out the words. The blood text. 2,900 pieces of gold from each pyramid, aye.' Skarhaz grumbled. 'It will be collected. But the loss of a few coins will never stay the Harpy's hand. Only blood can do that.'"
"So you say. The hostages again. He would kill them every one if I allowed it." "I heard you the first 100 times. No."
"Queen's hand," Skarhaz grumbled with disgust. "An old woman's hand, I'm thinking, wrinkled and feeble. I pray Daenerys returns to us soon."
He pulled his brazen wolf's mask down over his face.
"Your council will be growing restless."
"They are the queen's council, not mine." Selmy exchanged his damp cloak for a dry one and buckled on his sword belt, then accompanied the shave-pate down the steps. The pillared hall was empty of petitioners this morning. Though he had assumed the title of hand, Sir Barristan would not presume to hold court in the queen's absence, nor would he permit Skarhaz Mokandak to do such. Hisdar's grotesque dragon thrones had been removed at Sir Barristan's command,
but he had not brought back the simple pillared bench the queen had favoured. Instead, a large round table had been set up in the centre of the hall, with tall chairs all around it, where men might sit and talk as peers. They rose when Sir Barristan came down the marble steps, Scarha's shavepate at his side. Marcellin, of the mother's men, was present, with Simon Stripeback, commander of the Free Brothers. The stalwart shields had chosen a new commander, a black-skinned summer islander called Tal Torak, their old captain, Malona Yazdub, having been carried off by the pale mare. Greyworm was there for the unsolid, attended by three eunuch sergeants in spiked bronze caps. The Stormcrows were represented by two seasoned sellswords, an archer named Jokin, and the scarred and sour axeman known simply as the Widower. The two of them had assumed joint command of the company in the absence of Dario Naharis. Most of the Queen's Khalasar had gone with Argo and Rakaro to search for her on the Dothraki Sea, but the squinty, bow-legged Jacaran Romo was there to speak for the riders who remained. And across the table from Sir Barristan sat four of King Hisdar's erstwhile guardsmen. The pit fighters, Gogor the Giant, Bellicro Bonebreaker, Cameron of the Count, and the Spotted Cat. Selmy had insisted on their presence over the objections of Skaha Shavepate. They had helped Daenerys Targaryen take the city once, and that should not be forgotten. Blood-soaked brutes and killers they might be, but in their own way they had been loyal. To King Hisdar, yes, but to the Queen as well. Last to come, Strong Belwas lumbered into the hall. The eunuch had looked death in the face, so near he might have kissed her on the lips. It had marked him. He looked to have lost 2 stone in weight, and the dark bronze skin that had once stretched tight across a massive chest and belly, crossed by 100 faded scars, now hung on him in loose folds, sagging and wobbling, like a robe cut 3 sizes too large. His step had slowed as well, and seemed a bit uncertain. Even so, the sight of him gladdened the old knight's heart. He had once crossed the world with Strong Belwas, and he knew he could rely on him, should all this come to swords.
"Belwas, we are pleased that you could join us."
"Whitebeard,"
Belwas smiled.
"Where is Liver and Onions? Strong Belwas is not so strong as before. He must eat. Get big again. They made Strong Belwas sick. Someone must die."
"Someone will. Many someones, like as not. Sit, my friend." When Belwas sat and crossed his arms, Sir Barristan went on.
"Quentin Martell died this morning, just before the dawn."
The widower laughed.
"The Dragon Rider."
"Fool, I call him," said Simon Stripeback.
"No, just a boy." Sir Barristan had not forgotten the follies of his own youth.
"Speak no ill of the dead. The prince paid a ghastly price for what he did."
"And the other Dornish?"
asked Tal Tarak. Prisoners for the nonce. Neither of the Dornish men had offered any resistance. Archibald Ironwood had been cradling his prince's scorched and smoking body when the brazen beasts had found him, as his burned hands could testify. He had used them to beat out the flames that had engulfed Quentin Martell. Gareth Drinkwater was standing over them with a sword in hand, but he had dropped the blade the moment the locusts had appeared.
"They share a cell."
"Let them share a gibbet," said Simon Stripeback. "They unleashed 2 dragons on the city."
"Open the pits and give them swords," urged the Spotted Cap. "I will kill them both, as all Meereen shouts out my name."
"The fighting pits will remain closed," said Selmy. "Blood and noise would only serve to call the dragons."
"All 3, perhaps," suggested Marcellin. "The black beast came once, why not again? This time with our queen."
"Or without her? Should Drogon return to Meereen without Daenerys mounted on his back, the city would erupt in blood and flame. Of that Sir Barristan had no doubt. The very men now sitting at this table would soon be at dagger's point with one another. A young girl she might be, but Daenerys Targaryen was the only thing that held them all together.
"Her Grace will return when she returns," said Sir Barristan. "We have herded 1,000 sheep into the Dasnak's pit, filled the pit of Graz with bullocks, and the golden pit with beasts that Hisdar Zolorek had gathered for his games. Thus far, both dragons seemed to have a taste for mutton, returning to Dasnak's whenever they grew hungry. If either one was hunting man, inside or outside the city, Sir Barristan had yet to hear of it. The only Meereenese the dragons had slain, since Hargar's the hero, had been the slavers foolish enough to object when Rhaegar attempted to make his lair atop the pyramid of Hazgar. "We have more pressing matters to discuss. I have sent the Green Grace to the Yunkish men to make arrangements for the release of our hostages. I expect her back by midday with their answer."
"With words," said the widower, "the stone crows know the Yunkai. Their tongues are worms that wriggle this way or that. The Green Grace will come back with worm words, not the captain."
"If it pleases the Queen's hand to recall, the wise masters hold a hero too," said Grey Worm. "Also the horse lord Jogo, the Queen's own blood rider."
"Blood of her blood," agreed the Dothraki Roma. "He must be freed. The honour of the Khalasar demands it."
"He shall be freed," said Sir Barristan.
"But first we must needs wait and see if the Green Grace can accomplish—"
Scar her shave pate slammed his fist upon the table.
"The Green Grace will accomplish nothing. She may be conspiring with the Yunkar even as we sit here. Arrangements, do you say? Make arrangements? What sort of arrangements?"
"Ransom," said Sir Barristan. "Each man's weight in gold."
"The wise masters do not need our gold, sir," said Marcellin. "They are richer than your Westerosi lords, every one."
"Their sellswords will want the gold, though. What are the hostages to them? If the Yunkishmen refuse, it will drive a blade between them and their hirelings." "Or so I hope. It had been Missandei who suggested the ploy to him. He would never have thought of such a thing himself. In King's Landing, bribes had been Littlefinger's domain, whilst Lord Varys had the task of fostering division amongst the Crown's enemies. His own duties had been more straightforward."
11 years of age, yet Missandei is as clever as half the men at this table, and wiser than all of them. I have instructed the Green Grace to present the offer only when all of the Yunkish commanders have assembled to hear it."
"They will refuse, even so," insisted Simon Stripeback. "They will say they want the dragons dead, the king restored."
"I pray that you are wrong,
and fear that you are right."
"Your guards are far away, Sir Grandfather," said the widower. "I do not think they hear your prayers. And when the Yunkai send back the old woman to spit in your eye, what then?"
"Fire and blood," said Barristan Selmy, softly, softly. For a long moment, no one spoke. Then Strong Belwar slapped his belly and said,
"Better than liver and onions."
And Scarha's shapepate stared through the eyes of his wolf's head mask and said,
"You would break King Hasdar's peace, old man?"
"I would shatter it." Once, long ago, a prince had named him Barristan the Bold. A part of that boy was in him still. "We have built a beacon atop the pyramid where once the harpy stood. Dry wood, soaked with oil, covered to keep the rain off. Should the hour come, and I pray that it does not, we will light that beacon. The flames will be your signal to pour out of our gates and attack. Every man of you will have a part to play, so every man must be in readiness at all times, day or night. We will destroy our foes or be destroyed ourselves."
He raised a hand to signal to his waiting squires.
I've had some maps prepared to show the dispositions of our foes, their camps and siege lines and trebuchets. If we can break the slavers, their cell swords will abandon them. I know you will have concerns and questions. Voice them here. By the time we leave this table, all of us must be of a single mind, with a single purpose.
Best send down some food and drink, then, suggested Simon Stripeback. This will take a while.
It took the rest of the morning and most of the afternoon. The captains and commanders argued over the maps like fishwives over a bucket of crabs. Weak points and strong points, how to best employ their small company of archers, whether the elephants should be used to break the Yunkish lines or held in reserve. Who should have the honour of leading the first advance, whether their horse cavalry was best deployed on the flanks or in the vanguard. Sir Barristan let each man speak his mind. Tal Turek thought that they should march on Yunkai once they had broken through the lines. The Yellow City would be almost undefended, so the Yunkai would have no choice but to lift the siege and follow. The Spotted Cat proposed to challenge the enemy to send forth a champion to face him in single combat. Strong Belwas liked that notion, but insisted he should fight, not the cat. Cameron of the Count put forth a scheme to seize the ships tied up along the riverfront and use the Skahazadan to bring 300 pit fighters around the Yunkish rear. Every man there agreed that the Unsullied were their best troops, but none agreed on how they should be deployed. The widower wanted to use the eunuchs as an iron fist to smash through the heart of the Yunkish defences. Marcellin felt they would be better placed at either end of the main battle line, where they could beat back any attempt by the foe to turn their flanks. Simon Stripeback wanted them split into three and divided amongst the three companies of freedmen. His free brothers were brave and eager for the fight, he claimed, but without the Unsullied to stiffen them, he feared his unblooded troops might not have the discipline to face battle-seasoned sellswords by themselves. Grey Worm said only that the Unsullied would obey, whatever might be asked of them. And when all that had been discussed, debated, and decided, Simon Stripeback raised one final point.
As a slave in Yunkai, I helped my master bargain with the free companies and sought the payment of their wages. I know sellswords, and I know that the Yunkai cannot pay them near enough to face Dragon Flame. So I ask you, if the peace should fail and this battle should be joined, will the dragons come? Will they join the fight?
They will come, Sir Barristan might have said. The noise will bring them, the shouts and screams, the scent of blood. That will draw them to the battlefield, just as the roar from Dasnak's pit drew Drogon to the Scarlet Sands. But when they come, will they know one side from the other? Somehow he did not think so. So he said only, "The dragons will do what the dragons will do. If they do come, it may be just the shadow of their wings will be enough to dishearten the slavers and send them fleeing." Then he thanked them and dismissed them all.
Grey Worm lingered after the others had left.
"These ones will be ready when the beacon fire is lit, but the hand must surely know that when we attack, the Yunkai will kill the hostages."
"I will do all I can to prevent that, my friend. I have a notion, but pray excuse me. It is past time the Dornishmen heard that their prince is dead."
Grey Worm inclined his head.
"This one obeys."
Sir Barristan took two of his new-made knights with him down into the dungeons. Grief and guilt have been known to drive good men into madness, and Archibald Ironwood and Gerris Drinkwater had both played roles in their friend's demise. But when they reached the cell, he told Tum and the Red Lamb to wait outside, whilst he went in to tell the Dornish that the prince's agony was over.
Sir Archibald, the big bald one, had nothing to say. He sat on the edge of his pallet, staring down at his bandaged hands in their linen wrappings. Sir Gareth punched a wall. "I told him it was folly. I begged him to go home. Your bitch of a queen had no use for him. Any man could see that. He crossed the world to offer her his love and fealty, and she laughed in his face." "She never laughed," said Selmy. "If you knew her, you would know that." "She spurned him. He offered her his heart, and she threw it back at him, and went off to fuck her sellsword." "You had best guard that tongue, sir." Sir Barristan did not like this Gareth Drinkwater, nor would he allow him to vilify Daenerys. "Prince Quentin's death was his own doing, and yours."
"Ours? How are we at fault, sir? Quentin was our friend, yes. A bit of a fool, you might say, but all dreamers are fools. But first and last, he was our prince. We owed him our obedience."
Barristan Selmy could not dispute the truth of that. He had spent the best part of his own life obeying the commands of drunkards and madmen.
"He came too late."
"He offered her his heart," Sir Gareth said again.
"She needed swords, not hearts."
"He would have given her the Spears of Dawn as well."
"Would that he had."
No one had wanted Daenerys to look with favour on the Dornish prince more than Barristan Selmy. "He came too late, though, and this folly, buying sell swords, loosing two dragons on the city, that was madness, and worse than madness, that was treason."
"What he did for love of Queen Daenerys,"
Gareth Drinkwater insisted, "to prove himself worthy of her hand." The old knight had heard enough.
"What Prince Quentin did, he did for Dawn. Do you take me for some doting grandfather? I have spent my life around kings and queens and princes. Sunspear means to take up arms against the Iron Throne. No, do not trouble to deny it. Doran Martell is not a man to call his spears without hope of victory. Duty brought Prince Quentin here. Duty, honour, thirst for glory, never love. Quentin was here for dragons, not Daenerys."
"You did not know him, sir. He's dead, Drink."
Armwood rose to his feet.
"Words won't fetch him back. Cletus and Will are dead too. So shut your bloody mouth before I stick my fist in it."
The big knight turned to Selmy.
"What do you mean to do with us?"
"Scarha's Shavepate wants you hanged. You slew four of his men, four of the Queen's men. Two were freedmen who had followed her grace since Astapor."
Armwood did not seem surprised.
"The beast men, aye. I only killed the one, the basilisk head. The cell swords did the others. Don't matter, though, I know that."
"We were protecting Quentin," said Drinkwater.
"Be quiet, Drink. He knows."
To Sir Barristan, the big knight said,
"No need to come and talk, if you meant to hang us. So it's not that, is it?"
"No. This one may not be as slow-witted as he seems. I have more use for you alive than dead. Serve me, and afterward I will arrange a ship to take you back to Dawn, and give you Prince Quentin's bones to return to his lord father."
Sir Archibald grimaced.
"Why is it always ships? Someone needs to take Quent home, though. What do you ask of us, sir?"
"Your swords."
"You have thousands of swords."
"The Queen's freedmen are as yet unblooded. The cell swords I do not trust. Unsolid are brave soldiers, but not warriors, not knights." He paused. "What happened when you tried to take the dragons? Tell me."
The Dornishman exchanged a look. Then Drinkwater said,
"Quentin told the tattered prince he could control them. It was in his blood, he said. He had Targaryen blood."
"Blood of the dragon?"
"Yes. The cell swords were supposed to help us get the dragons chained up, so we could get them to the ducks. Rags arranged for a ship, said Ironwood, a big one in case we got both dragons, and Quint was going to ride one. He looked at his bandaged hands. The moment we got in, though, you could see none of it was going to work. The dragons were too wild. The chains, they were bits of broken chain everywhere. Big chains. Links the size of your head mixed in with all these cracked and splintered bones. And Quint, Seven save him, he looked like he was going to shit his small clothes. Kago and Meris weren't blind, they saw it too. Then one of the crossbowmen let fly. Maybe they meant to kill the dragons all along and were only using us to get to them. You never know with tatters. Anyway, you hack it off. It weren't clever. The quarrel just made the dragons angry, and they hadn't been in such a good mood to start with. Then things got bad. And the windblown blew away, said Sir Gerus. Quint was screaming, covered in flames, and they were gone. Kago, Pretty Maris, all but the dead one. No, what did you expect, Drink? A cat would kill a mouse. A pig will wallow in shit. And a sellsword will run off when he's needed most. Can't be blamed. Just the nature of the beast.
He's not wrong, Sir Barristan said. What did Prince Quentin promise the tattered prince in return for all this help? He got no answer. Sir Gerus looked at Sir Archibald. Sir Archibald looked at his hands, the floor, the door. Pentos, said Sir Barristan. He promised him Pentos. Say it. No words of yours can help or harm Prince Quentin now.
Aye, said Sir Archibald, unhappily. It was Pentos. They made marks on a paper, the two of them.
There is a chance here. We still have the windblown in the dungeons, those feigned deserters.
I remember, said Ironwood. Hungerford, Straw, that lot. Some of them weren't so bad for sellswords. Others, well, might be they could stand a bit of dying. What of them?
I mean to send them back to the tattered prince, and you with them. You will be two amongst thousands. Your presence in the Yunkish camps should pass unnoticed. I want you to deliver a message to the tattered prince. Tell him that I sent you, that I speak with the queen's voice. Tell him that we will pay his price if he delivers us our hostages, unharmed and whole. Sir Archibald grimaced.
Rags and tatters is more like to give the two of us to Pretty Meris. He won't do it.
Why not? The task is simple enough, compared to stealing dragons. I once brought the Queen's father out of Duskendale.
That was Westeros, said Gerus Drinkwater.
This is Meereen. Arch cannot even hold a sword with those hands. He ought not need to. You will have the sail swords with you, unless I mistake my man. Gerus Drinkwater pushed back his mop of sun-streaked hair.
Might we have some time to discuss this amongst ourselves?
No, said Selmy.
I'll do it, offered Sir Archibald, just so long as there's no bloody boats involved. Drink will do it too, he grinned. He don't know it yet, but he will.
And that was done. The simple part, at least, thought Barristan Selmy, as he made the long climb back to the summit of the pyramid. The hard part he'd left in Dornish hands. His grandfather would have been aghast. The Dornishmen were knights, at least in name, though only Ironwood impressed him as having the true steel. Drinkwater had a pretty face, a glib tongue, and a fine head of hair. By the time the old knight returned to the queen's rooms atop the pyramid, Prince Quentin's corpse had been removed. Six of the young cupbearers were playing some child's game as he entered, sitting in a circle on the floor as they took turns spinning a dagger. When it wobbled to a stop, they cut a lock of hair off whichever of them the blade was pointing at. Sir Barristan had played a similar game with his cousins when he was just a boy at Harvest Hall,
though in Westeros, as he recalled, kissing had been involved as well.
"Buckhouse," he called, a cup of wine, if you would be so good. Grashar, Azak, the door is yours. I am expecting the Green Grace. Show her in at once when she arrives. Elsewise, I do not wish to be disturbed."
Azak scrambled to his feet.
"As you command, Lord Hand."
Sir Barristan went out onto the terrace. The rain had stopped, though a wall of slate-grey clouds hid the setting sun as it made its descent into Slaver's Bay. A few wisps of smoke still rose from the blackened stones of Hasdar, twisted like ribbons by the wind. Far off to the east, beyond the city walls, he saw pale wings moving above a distant line of hills. Viserion. Hunting, mayhaps, or flying just to fly. He wondered where Rhaegal was. Thus far, the Green Dragon had shown himself to be more dangerous than the White. When Bakhars brought his wine, the old knight took one long swallow and sent the boy for water. A few cups of wine might be just the thing to help him sleep, but he would need his wits about him when Galaza Galare returned from treating with the foe. So he drank his wine well-watered as the world grew dark around him. He was very tired and full of doubts. The Dornish men, Hisdar, Resnik, the attack. Was he doing the right things? Was he doing what Daenerys would have wanted? I was not made for this. Other Kingsguard had served as hand before him. Not many, but a few. He had read of them in the White Book. Now he found himself wondering whether they had felt as lost and confused as he did.
"Lord Hand."
Grashar stood in the door, a taper in his hand.
"The Green Grace has come. You asked to be told."
"Show her in and light some candles."
Galaza Galare was attended by four pink graces. An aura of wisdom and dignity seemed to surround her that Sir Barristan could not help but admire. "This is a strong woman, and she has been a faithful friend to Daenerys."
"Lord Hand," she said,
her face hidden behind shimmering green veils.
"May I sit? These bones are old and weary. Grashar, a chair for the Green Grace."
The pink graces arrayed themselves behind her, with eyes lowered and hands clasped before them.
"May I offer you refreshment?" asked Sir Barristan. "That would be most welcome, Sir Barristan. My throat is dry from talking. A juice, perhaps."
"As you wish." He beckoned to Casimir and had her fetch the priestess a goblet of lemon juice sweetened with honey. To drink it, the priestess had to remove her veil, and Selmy was reminded of just how old she was.
20 years, my elder, or more. If the Queen were here, I know that she would join me in thanking you for all that you have done for us. Her magnificence has always been most gracious."
Galaza Galare finished her drink and fastened up her veil again.
"Have there been any further tidings of our sweet queen?"
"None as yet."
"I shall pray for her. And what of King Hisdar, if I may be so bold? Might I be permitted to see his radiance?"
"Soon, I hope. He is unharmed, I promise you."
"I'm pleased to hear that. The wise masters of Yunkai asked after him. You will not be surprised to hear that they wish the noble Hisdar to be restored at once to his rightful place."
"He shall be, if it can be proved that he did not try to kill our queen. Until such time, Meereen will be ruled by a council of the loyal and just. There is a place for you on that council. I know that you have much to teach us all, your benevolence. We need your wisdom."
"I fear you flatter me with empty courtesies, Lord Hand,"
the Green Grace said.
"If you truly think me wise, heed me now. Release the noble Hisdar and restore him to his throne.
Only the Queen can do that. Beneath her veils, the green grace sighed.
The peace that we work so hard to forge flutters like a leaf in an autumn wind. These are